Welcome to the Master of None podcast, adventures in a hands-on life. Build, grow, cook, train, explore. So we just recently did a couple episodes that were all about sailing. Specifically, we were talking about traveling the world in your own sailing vessel. And we talked about the boat that you would need, maybe how to go about getting that type of boat, and the knowledge and skills that you would also need, how to go about getting those knowledge and skills in order to attempt to do something like that safely. And I ended up getting a lot of feedback, a lot of questions about those episodes. So, first of all, thank you for all of that, for all of that good feedback and all of those questions. And I thought maybe now would be a good time, while it's still fresh in all of our minds, to just go ahead and address those questions with a sailing question and answer episode. And on all of these questions, I've removed any names, location information. It's just easier for me that way, so I don't have to worry about whether or not somebody wanted me to use their name or not or whatever. So we have a handful of questions. Let's go ahead and jump into them. First question. Hello. I really enjoyed the episodes about sailing. I've never even been on a sailboat before, but the idea of traveling the world on my own boat intrigues me. Obviously, like you talked about, I'd have to start with a basic sailing class and work my way up from there. Here's my question. You mentioned that you could go anywhere that you wanted to on a sailboat. But aren't you limited in where you can go based on what direction the wind is blowing? Along those same lines, if I have my boat in a harbor and I sail out of the harbor, how would I get back? Do you just sail one way and then run your motor to come back? That seems like it would defeat the purpose of sailing to travel without burning fuel. Am I missing something? Okay, so all of those questions are really related to the same concept, and I'll go into a little more detail. We're going to talk about something called points of sail in just a minute, but the short answer is that a modern sailing vessel, it wasn't always like this. It used to be like back when humans first started sailing, yeah, you kind of put up a sail if you happened to want to travel in the same direction that the wind was blowing. Your question is basically, let's say that the wind is blowing from the west. Well, how do I get to the west if that's where the wind is blowing from? So with modern sail design, you can sail into the wind. And that's basically because your sail, instead of just acting as like a cup that catches the wind, your sail's really acting more like a wing that the wind is blowing across, creating basically the sideways equivalent of lift, creating that force that pulls your boat forward. And especially when you have multiple sails, so, or think of your standard sailboat, like just imagine a basic sailboat with two triangular sails. What that jib that's further forward is actually doing is, in addition to providing some, quote, lift of its own, it's also redirecting more wind across the back, what would be the back of the mainsail, creating even more lift on that sail. So that's kind of a very much oversimplified way of thinking about it, but basically what that allows you to do, and yes, there's a lot more that goes into it with like balancing the sails so that the boat steers in a straight line. We don't need to get into all of that. Anyway, basically what that allows you to do in most boats, and there's some variation, some boats can sail a little higher into the wind, some a little less so, but in general, there is a 90 degree window that you cannot sail into, which would be basically 45 degrees on either side of the wind. So picture this as like on the face of a clock. We're going to say that the wind is coming from 12 o'clock. We always talk about the direction that the wind's coming from. So the wind's coming from 12 o'clock. Now, if your boat is in the center of that clock, you cannot sail directly toward 12 o'clock. And in fact, there's a 90 degree window that you cannot steer inside of. So that window would be 45 degrees on either side of that 12 o'clock wind direction. So basically from 10:30 to 1:30 is that 90 degree slice of pie that you cannot steer directly into. Now, the other three quarters of that circle, you can sail in any direction. So how do you actually work your way in that, well, let's call that 12 o'clock direction north, as though it were on a map. So the wind's coming directly from the north. Let's say that I want to get further north. How do I actually get there? Because I can sail directly northeast to that 1:30 position, or I can sail directly northwest toward that 10:30 position. If I want to work my way directly north, I do something called tacking. That's basically sailing directly northeast toward that 1:30 and then making a 90 degree turn through the wind. And you can turn through the wind as long as it's done properly. You won't lose all of your headway. You can make that 90 degree turn so that the wind is then coming across the other side of your boat, and you can trim your sails again. You let them come across. So I would be on what's called a port tack first, where the wind's actually coming across the port or left side of my boat, and my sails are trimmed over on the right side of my boat. When I tack, I'm going to loose my sails, turn 90 degrees to the left, which puts me on that northwesterly heading toward that 10:30 position on the clock. The wind is then coming at a 45 degree angle across my starboard bow, and my sails are trimmed on the port side. Now, I'm basically going to do a series of zigzags, making those 90 degree turns to work my way directly north. That's called tacking. So between the speed that I lose each time I make one of those turns and the fact that I'm actually having to travel a longer distance, think of that as basically roughly doubling the amount of time, or your actual progress is basically cut in half, but you're still able to travel in that direction. So if I were otherwise traveling at, say, 6 knots, tacking directly into the wind, I'm only going to make about 3 knots of headway directly in that northerly direction. Now, there are also terms that are used for any of those directions that you might be sailing in relation to the direction of the wind. So for this example, we're still going to have that clock face with the wind coming from 12 o'clock. We're going to overlay that onto a map so that wind is coming directly from the north, just to help you picture it in your head. So we're going to start with the closest we can point into the wind on a port tack, which is basically traveling toward that 1:30, that northeasterly course. Now, if we get too high into the wind, we're actually going to lose our ability to sail, and the boat will actually just come to a complete stop. The sails flutter around. It's called luffing. And you just can't keep everything tuned properly to continue traveling once you get into that zone, generally past that 45 degree angle. So if we're right at that 45 degree angle, which is right where we want to be if we're tacking north, we want to be right on that edge. That's called sailing close hauled. Specifically, this is going to be close hauled on a port tack because the wind is coming across the port side of our boat, and our sails are trimmed on the starboard side. Now, as we fall off the wind around that clock face, from that close hauled position all the way to that 3 o'clock position, which is actually called a beam reach. Specifically, that would be a port beam reach because the wind, if we're sailing directly east, the wind's coming across our port beam. So when we're sailing at 90 degrees to the wind, that's called a beam reach. Now, anything between close hauled and a beam reach is called a close reach. So that basically covers from 1:30 to 3 o'clock on our clock face. And when we're at 3 o'clock, That's a beam reach. Now, with most boats, a beam reach is actually the fastest that you can sail in any given wind condition. Now, intuitively, you might think, well, traveling directly with the wind, straight south toward that 6 o'clock position, that's going to be the fastest because that's where I'm going the same direction as the wind. Surprisingly, this is just based on the physics of the boat and the fact that we're using those sails as a wing to create that lift force to drive the boat forward, not just capturing the wind. The beam reach, where the wind is coming directly across your beam, actually ends up being your fastest point of sail. Now, little side note here before we continue around the clock face, and you're going to learn all about this when you go to that sailing class, but trimming the sails, there are actually a lot of nuanced techniques, but one thing that you're going to find when you're trimming your sails is that you need to balance the main and the jib. And if your jib is trimmed too tightly, you're actually going to have a tendency to fall off of the wind. The boat's going to want to turn away from the wind because there's more pressure on that forward portion of the boat, turning the boat away from the wind. Now, if your main is trimmed too tightly in relation to the jib, the opposite is going to happen where the boat's going to want to turn into the wind. And either way, you're going to have to be fighting that with your rudder, with your tiller, with your helm, depending on how your boat's configured, tiller versus helm. Anyway, you're going to have to fight that by steering to correct it. Now, if your sails are trimmed properly, you're going to have that balance between your main and your jib or your additional sails, depending on the rig that you're sailing. But when your sails are properly trimmed, the boat's actually going to naturally just kind of want to follow the same course, and you're not going to have to fight it with steering. You're not going to have to correct with steering and constantly be fighting that. So that was just a little side note. Let's continue around our clock face. So we're sailing at that 3 o'clock heading. That's called a beam reach. Now, as we fall off further, that next quarter of the pie between 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock is called a broad reach. So we went from close hauled, close reach, beam reach, broad reach. So we're actually sailing downwind, not straight downwind, but we're sailing downwind once we're past that 3 o'clock. So we're not going to be tacking. Tacking is that maneuver of crossing the wind with your bow so that you go from, for example, a port tack to starboard tack, vice versa, to do that zigzag pattern to work our way into the wind. Now, if the wind crosses our stern, that's called jibing. That's a different maneuver, and you'll learn all about that in your sailing classes too. But for purposes of, I'm not going to call it navigation, for purposes of steering around other vessels and who is the stand-on vessel and who is the giveaway vessel, when we're in that 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock position, we are still considered to be on a port tack. Even though we are not physically tacking as a maneuver, the wind is still coming across the port side of our vessel. Our sails are still trimmed on the starboard side of the vessel, so we are on a port tack. That's important because, in general, a vessel that's on a port tack is required to give way to a vessel that's on a starboard tack. So, continuing around the clock, we're now on that 6 o'clock heading. So the wind is coming from 12 o'clock due north, and we're sailing due south. The wind is directly behind us when it comes to our relative wind. It's directly behind us. Now, this is called running, or sailing at a dead run. This is actually where the expression at a dead run comes from, not from sprinting, surprisingly, but from sailing. Now, when you're at a dead run, you actually change the physics of how you're using your sails. So you're no longer using them as that wing, that airfoil shape, to create lift to drive your boat forward. You're now basically just throwing up as much sail as possible to use it as a big bag to catch as much wind, and you're doing that more primitive style of sailing where you're just going in the same direction as the wind. You're just allowing yourself to be blown along. And oftentimes here, you're going to actually rig, if you're sailing a sloop-type rig with a jib and a mainsail, you're actually going to typically pull your jib across to the other side. Otherwise, it ends up in the wind shadow of the main. So for example, let's say that we were on that port tack. Let's say we're on a port beam reach and we're slowly falling off of the wind. We're then on that broad reach. So both of our sails are still over on the starboard side. And then either we make a course correction to starboard, putting the wind directly at our backs, or maybe the wind shifts and ends up directly at our backs in that same direction that we want to travel. Well, we have both of our sails all the way out on the starboard side of our boat. But at this point, the jib isn't catching any wind because, like I said, it's in the wind shadow of that main. Now, typically what we're going to do here is go ahead and just loose the jib sheet, which is the line that you use to trim your jib. We're going to loose that starboard jib sheet and haul around on the port jib sheet to pull the jib over to the port side of our boat. So then we actually have the two sails rigged on opposite sides of the boat to just increase the overall surface area that the wind is blowing on. Now, continuing our way around the clock, at this point, if we were actually sailing, in order to continue to move from that 6 o'clock position over toward 9 o'clock, this is when we conduct a jibe maneuver. Now, our jib is already pulled over on the port side. So what we don't want to do is have the wind all of a sudden, because remember our main is rigged all the way out. Our boom is all the way out. And you'll see when you start sailing how dangerous this could be. We're going to haul that in as we turn to keep the wind from suddenly catching it and swinging the boom and the sail violently across the deck and possibly injuring somebody, knocking somebody overboard, any of that nonsense. We don't want to deal with that. So anyway, without going into the details of how to carry out that maneuver, let's just say from 6 o'clock around to 9 o'clock, that quarter of the pie, and actually the remainder of our points of sail have exactly the same terminology as the first half. We're just now on a starboard tack instead of a port tack. So again, we're going to be from at 6 o'clock, remember we're at a dead run, from 6 to 9, we're on a broad reach again. Now we're on a starboard broad reach. At 9 o'clock, we are on a beam reach, starboard beam reach. From 9 to 10:30, we're on a close reach, but a starboard close reach. And then at 10:30, when we're as high as we can point into the wind, we're basically sailing in that northwesterly direction. We're now close hauled on the starboard tack. Now, one more thing that I want to mention, because I don't want you to think as soon as you start sailing, you're going to be like, well, Isaac could only sail at 45 degrees into the wind. It seems like I'm doing a lot better than that. It seems like I'm pointing higher into the wind. A lot of people observe that to be true on their boats when they're sailing. Here's why. It's something called apparent wind. Now, at the top of your mast, you're going to have a little wind vane, which is basically a little arrow thing with a little tail on the end to catch the wind so that the arrow points directly into the wind so you can see exactly what direction the wind is coming from. And then typically this wind vane on a sailboat is actually going to have two little kind of arms that come out at 90 degrees from each other to create that 45 degree mark on either side of dead into the wind. So basically you just have to make sure that your wind vane does not cross into that what's called no-go zone. The thing is, though, once the boat itself is moving, it creates its own additional wind vector. Meaning, like, think about when you're driving in your car, let's say that you have a convertible or a Jeep or something, or the windows down or whatever, and it's a dead calm day, but you're driving at 20 miles an hour, well, you physically feel 20 miles an hour of wind on your face, even though there is no wind. The same thing happens with your sailboat and with that wind vane, is once the boat is traveling forward, any forward motion of the boat tends to make the wind vane point more forward, because the wind vane just feels that additional wind from the motion of the boat. So, in reality, if you were to observe the boat from above and observe its actual direction of travel and the actual wind direction, you're really never going to get inside, maybe a tiny bit, but not much inside that 90 degree slice. But from your actual position down on the boat, observing your wind vane, it feels like you are sailing higher into the wind than you actually are. So I don't want to get into too much detail here because we could talk for hours about some of these nuances, but some of this really comes into play if you're racing competitively, because like I mentioned, a beam reach is always going to be your fastest point of sail. Now keep in mind, when you're actually on a beam reach, that wind vane is going to look a little different. It's not actually going to be pointing directly off your beam. It's going to be pointing mostly off your beam, but a little bit ahead. So realizing kind of those nuances of your boat are actually going to allow you to drive your boat a little bit faster and maybe just get that competitive edge. Like I said, we're not going to get too much in the weeds on that. So the short answer to your question is that we have all of these points of sail where we can basically sail 3/4 of that pie. And if we need to get into that direction that's directly into the wind, we carry out that tacking maneuver, do that zigzag course to work our way into the wind. And with that, you're really able to travel overall. Your overall course of travel, you can go in any direction you want, regardless of the wind direction. Okay, next question. Hey, Isaac, I just finished listening to the first sailboat episode. You mentioned that you believe that a sailboat is generally more seaworthy than a motorized boat of the same length. I'm having trouble wrapping my head around that idea. Obviously, boats with sails are older technology than boats with engines, so why would that technology be more seaworthy? Also, if that's the case, why wouldn't we just build modern boats with motors so that they're just as seaworthy as sailboats? Please explain. Also, why don't boats just get carried along by a big wave the way that a surfboard does? Also, just out of curiosity, what are the biggest waves you've ever sailed in at sea? Thanks for all the great info you always provide, and sorry for asking multiple questions. Okay, no worries about the multiple questions. That's what I'm here for. Let's start with your last question. What are the biggest waves I've ever sailed in at sea? 10 meters plus. Why don't boats just get carried along by big waves? We're going to go through your questions backwards because I think that's easier. So, one of the important things to realize with just the way that waves work, and we could go into a lot of physics. I'm going to try to answer this in a simple fashion to just help you wrap your head around it. It's important to understand that a wave at sea is more of an energy wave than it is actually moving water. And yes, some water is moving around, but in general, the wave traveling is energy, not matter. What do I mean by that? Well, if you tie a rope to something and then you stand off at the other end of the rope and you start shaking it up and down, you can kind of send waves down the rope. Well, the rope itself, the actual matter of the rope is not moving. It's still in the same place it started in. Yes, it has that up and down movement, but the actual fibers of the rope end up in the same place they started. Think of waves in the water as being the same thing, where the movement caused by that energy is more just up and down movement of the water. The water itself is not actually traveling at the speed of the wave. So what ends up happening is as the water goes up, you know, you have a wave coming and the water level physically rises as the wave passes, because we're thinking of the wave and the water as being two separate things. The wave is that energy that's passing. The water itself is basically staying put, but as that energy wave passes, the water goes up, lifts the boat, the wave passes, the water goes down, and so does the boat. So now why does a surfboard end up surfing? I don't think that an audio podcast is the best place for me to try to explain that without doing some drawings. It's basically physics and addition of force vectors. There you go. Back to our waves at sea, though. This is kind of why... I'm trying to make sure... I'm going to try and make sure that I don't confuse you by adding some information here. The wave, not the water, but the wave might be traveling relatively fast. You might have waves at sea that are traveling at 20, 30, 40 knots. But those waves are stretched out. So as those waves, quote, hit your boat, they're, let's say that it's a 10-foot high wave and it's traveling at 20 knots. And that sounds pretty scary, getting hit by a 10-foot wave that's traveling at 20 knots. But that wave may actually be stretched out over quite some distance. So maybe you actually have a wave period between those consecutive waves of 10, 20 seconds or more. So your boat is actually only traveling that up and down distance of that 10-foot height of the wave. It's not actually getting like a sideways impact from that wave. Until you get into the surf, and then that's completely different physics. We're not going to get into what happens when waves hit shallow water. Anyway, let's get back to your first question in here, which is first two questions. I'm going to tie those together, which is what actually makes a sailing vessel more seaworthy, like the actual physics of it, and why we don't just build modern boats with motors to be just as seaworthy as sailboats. The short answer is that since sailboats have sails, you're applying force to them at a relative position high up above the hull. Now, that's basically creating leverage that's going to tend to tip the boat over. So the sailboat has to be built with a hull that will counteract that, usually with something we call ballast built into the hull. Now that can be lead that's actually, even in a fiberglass boat, that can be lead that's actually like cast into the fiberglass of the keel. And you also have this deep keel that's doing a couple things. One of the things it's doing is getting that weight down deep in the water, down low, to counteract the leverage of the wind pushing on the sails. The keel is also helping the boat to track straight through the water because it's, you know, think of it as a fin, like on a fish or something. And the final thing that it's doing is it's actually providing a sideways resistance to the boat tipping. So that rapid tip that another boat might not have something to resist, the actual force of the water against the surface area of the keel, it'll resist that rapid tip. And maybe that's an oversimplification. Maybe some of my fellow naval architects are slapping their heads saying, no, you oversimplified it too much. I'm sorry. Whatever. The next part of your question is kind of, why don't we build modern boats with motors to be just as seaworthy? And we absolutely could. But since motor vessels don't have sails, they don't have that force, that leverage of the wind way up above the deck trying to knock them over. So we don't need to build them with that in mind to be able to counteract that. And on top of that, basically they're built for speed. And that's the short answer, is we're building motor vessels for optimizing them for speed. And you absolutely could throw a motor onto the hull of a sailing vessel and have something just as seaworthy as a sailing vessel. In fact, we pretty much always do that. Almost any sailing vessel that's designed for offshore cruising is also going to have a motor. So if you doused your sails and fired up the motor, that's basically exactly what you would have, is a motor vessel with all of the stability and seaworthiness of a sailing vessel hull design. The downside is it's not that fast. So it really comes down to engineering design priorities, I guess. Hope that answers your question. Next question. Greetings. I really enjoyed the sailboat episodes. When I was a kid, I took a few sailing lessons on small dinghies on our local reservoir. It was fun, but I haven't done any sailing since then. Sailing a larger boat offshore sounds like a completely different experience. and I'm going to start making some arrangements to try it out, crew or passenger for a day on someone else's boat. You made it sound as though it would be totally feasible to cross oceans on a sailboat. I know that it has been done, but aren't people out at sea for months and months to sail across the Atlantic? How long would some of these voyages actually take? Can you give some examples? I like the idea of relaxing and taking it slow, but I don't necessarily want to be pushing the limits of human endurance. And I really love this question because I think this is a great opportunity to kind of put some of these distances in perspective. And really all this is some distance, speed, time calculations. And I realize that most people who don't spend a lot of time at sea kind of have this frame of reference where they may have a pretty good idea of the distances to different places on the landmass where they live, but not necessarily that really good mental image of those distances once it comes to crossing seas. So let's do some examples here. Now let's start with the assumption. Well, let's back up. Let's talk distance, speed, time. For any object that is traveling, so that's going to include your sailing vessel, there is a simple distance, speed, time calculation. And that's that distance traveled equals speed times time. So when it comes to ships at sea, we generally speak in nautical miles and knots. So nautical miles being the distance part, knots being the speed part. A knot is simply 1 nautical mile per hour. And a nautical mile, turns out, is just a little bit longer than a statute mile. So if I say miles, just know that I'm talking about nautical miles. But in your head, if you have a good frame of reference for a statute mile, think of it as being the same thing. They're very close to the same. So the next question, I guess, is how fast does your sailboat go? Now, most cruising boats, it would be very, very reasonable to expect to make an average of 5 knots. That's not really pushing the limits of anything at all. And even if we talk a little more conservatively, say maybe just over 4 knots, because there are 24 hours in a day. So if we multiply a speed that's just a hair over 4 knots times 24 hours in a day, comes out to 100 miles per day, which is just a really easy calculation. Then anything faster than that, you're just getting there quicker. So let's say that we can make 100 miles per day. Now on these offshore trips, we're actually going to be cruising 24 hours a day. So even though we're traveling relatively slowly compared to, say, your car when you're driving on the interstate, you're not driving 24 hours a day, because what we're going to do is, you know, we're not stopping at the rest area. We're not stopping for gas or to eat, and we're not even stopping to sleep because we're going to change watches. And maybe we'll talk a little more about that later. I think that actually came up in one of the other questions, so we'll get to that. But we're actually making that 4 or 5 knots for 24 of the 24 hours of the day. So that allows us to basically cover 100 miles per 24-hour period conservatively. And you might end up doing a lot better than that. Maybe you have really favorable wind conditions, and maybe you're making 8.5 knots. And all of a sudden, your trip only takes half the time because you're covering 200 nautical miles per day per 24-hour period. So let's even say that, I'm just trying to put some of this in perspective. You know what? Never mind. We're going to save that for this question where they bring up watch standing. Let's right now just talk about what the boat can do, assuming that you're covering that 100 miles per day. Well, here are some examples. From Miami to Cuba is only 90 miles. So you can get there in less than a day, less than a 24-hour period. From, say, West Palm Beach to Grand Bahama is only about 60 miles. So you can actually get there in like a little over half a day. And obviously, if we're talking about coastal cruising, you can kind of hop from port to port and possibly, you know, plan your trip, and you could possibly pull into a safe harbor every single night so that you're never even sailing at night. Obviously, ocean crossings are going to be a little different, but let's say that you're just cruising around the Caribbean. Well, there are so many islands in the Caribbean that you could feasibly sail around many of those islands and visit many countries without ever having to sail for more than a day. You can plan your trip so that you're just island hopping without ever having more than a one-day sail between islands. Now, obviously, the same thing is going to be true as long as you're basically like sticking to either Western Hemisphere or Eastern Hemisphere, because you could feasibly sail all the way down the west coast of the Americas and back up the east coast of the Americas. Maybe you sail through the Panama Canal. Maybe, like, this is totally doable, just hopping from port to port without ever spending extended periods at sea. And like I said, if we plan on being able to cover 100 miles a day, that may not seem like a lot compared to, you know, what you can drive in your car on the interstate highway, but that does add up. A week of sailing, that gives you 700 miles of travel or more. So let's talk about the Atlantic crossing. There are different ways to do this, and some of it's going to depend on the time of year also, because that's a very important consideration anytime you're doing offshore sailing. You probably don't want to be in the Bering Sea in January, and you probably don't want to be in certain places during hurricane season. So definitely a consideration. But anyway, we're talking about possible Atlantic crossings. Now, you can, granted it's sparsely populated, but you can feasibly cross the North Atlantic without any of your at-sea legs between land being more than, I want to say 250 miles. It's possible to do that. Now, you might be able to make the trip shorter by doing some longer legs, but that is definitely possible. Now, that 250 miles, we're only talking 2 or 3 days at sea in a chunk, and then you could possibly pull into a port or harbor somewhere, get some rest, and then do the next leg of your journey. Now, crossing the Atlantic from east to west, from Europe to the Americas, there's a route across the Atlantic. It's often called the barefoot route, which people typically take in the winter. Like, I want to say the 1st of December is usually the earliest that people embark on that route. But it basically goes from the Canary Islands to the Antilles, I think. Sometimes people end up in the Bahamas. Anyway, either way, both good, right? So that, I believe, is a 2,500 mile at sea leg in one chunk, which might sound like a lot, but keep in mind we're covering at least 100 miles a day. So it's kind of standard actually for people to do that, even in a very laid back setting. They're not trying to like really crank every ounce of speed out of their boat. 21 days is kind of standard for that crossing. And that's actually quite a ways. To put that in perspective on land, I think that's about the same distance as, say, Los Angeles to Nova Scotia, or from, say, London to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. So you're covering a lot of distance, but you're just kind of trucking through, kind of relaxed, doing some fishing, hanging out on the boat, reading some books. So I hope that kind of answers your question. You're really not even for an Atlantic crossing, you're not looking at weeks and week or months and months at sea. 3 weeks is totally doable for an Atlantic crossing by sail. All right, next question. Hello, Isaac. After listening to the Pirates Life episodes, I found myself lost on Google Earth. I was imagining crossing the Pacific from San Diego to Australia. Side note from me, Pacific crossing is probably a much more daunting task than an Atlantic crossing. It's just a bigger ocean. Anyway, crossing from San Diego to Australia, stopping at tiny islands along the way. I was looking at vast expanses of ocean, hundreds of miles, separating some of these tiny islands. Of course, then I would zoom in on the satellite view of some of those little islands, and I could see sandy beaches, palm trees, coral reefs, sheltered lagoons. On one of them, I even saw a 45-foot sailboat anchored in the lagoon. Measured it with the Google Earth ruler. Nice. I could just imagine myself grilling some fresh fish on the beach. That particular one was a small ring-shaped island, (atoll?) Yes, that's what those are called, with nothing around it for hundreds of miles. How on earth did they find it? Seems like many of those islands are so small that they would be almost impossible to find. If I leave one island and my steering is even a few degrees off, I'd be afraid that I'd sail right past the island I was aiming for. How do you find a tiny island in the middle of a vast ocean? I'm sure there are some navigational skills that would allow me to do this, but with my current level of knowledge, it seems out of reach. All right. I love this question because I kind of geek out on navigation and ship handling, and you brought up a bunch of stuff that is going to be really fun to talk about real quick. So, first thing, bad news and good news. Bad news first. The bad news is that even if your steering is perfect, you're still going to miss the island. And that's because there are just so many other forces with waves and wind and ocean currents that are acting on your boat that even if you drew that perfectly straight line from your current position to that island that you're trying to find and you got on that heading and steered perfectly with all of those other forces acting on your boat, by the time you've traveled, say, several hundred miles, there's a good chance that you could have drifted far enough off course. Even though you're maintaining that perfect heading, you may have drifted far enough off of that line that you drew on your chart that you may not even see the island as you sail past it. Now, the method that we're talking about there, where you basically set a course and then multiply your speed times your time to figure out how far you've traveled along that course, is called dead reckoning navigation, which is very useful, but it has to be periodically interrupted with getting something that we call a good fix. So that dead reckoning is assuming that you're basically traveling along that course. Maybe you do that for a while and then you get what's called a good fix, which is your actual position on your chart, your actual position on the surface of the Earth. And there are multiple ways to do that. Let's actually just run through a few of those ways to get a good fix. One is a visual fix. Visual fix is essentially shooting a compass bearing to known landmarks, correlating that to your chart. So that could be to to some sort of marker. It could be to a light. It could be to some sort of tower, a lighthouse, all sorts of stuff that's marked in a precise location on your chart. You basically shoot those compass bearings and then do a reverse bearing from there, drawing a line on your chart. And where those lines cross is your actual position. And I've kind of oversimplified even that, because that would be if you're not moving. If you're moving, then you have to actually advance those lines along your track in addition to shooting the bearings. And we're getting into some more complex navigational stuff there. But that visual fix is one method of getting a good fix. You can also get a radar fix if you have an accurate radar set up, and you can get an accurate distance with your radar. Now that's something to realize, that radar tends to be very good at distance and not so good at precise directions. So let's say that you can see a radar reflector on your radar scope, and it says that it is in a certain direction at a certain distance. Well, you can pretty much rely on that distance, but the bearing may not be as accurate. So you can kind of do the same thing with getting the distance to known objects, but instead of drawing a line, you basically strike an arc from those objects on your chart, and where those arcs cross, that's your position. You can get an electronic fix, is what it's called, when you basically read the latitude and longitude coordinates off of a GPS unit and transfer those over onto your chart. That's an electronic fix. You can get a celestial fix, which is based on the observation of sun, moon, stars, planets, That's another way to do it. And of all of those, the celestial navigation definitely takes the most training in order to be able to actually do that. So anyway, any of those good fix methods, pinpoint your location with both a latitude and a longitude on your chart. When I say chart, I'm talking either an electronic chart plotter or paper charts. Now, I would personally never go to sea without paper charts. There are just too many things that can go wrong with an electronic chart plotter. Like, for example, it's dependent on electricity. When you're at sea on a sailboat for days or weeks at a time, there are so many things that could go wrong with your ability to produce and or store electricity. And if you don't have that power, your chart plotter is just not going to work. So even if it's just as a backup, you should at least have and know how to use your paper charts as well. So let's say that we've been sailing along certain course and speed, marking our dead reckoning fixes along the way, and then we stop, well, we don't stop, we continue sailing, but we get a good fix, and we can compare our dead reckoning position to that good fix, which tells us how much all of those outside factors have pushed us off course. Now, the fun thing here is that you can then make a course correction based on that. Say, you know, it's pushing us due north at half a knot. Okay. Well, you can translate that to your chart and make that course correction so that hopefully the next good fix that you get is right on that course that you were planning. And of course, that tiny island that you're trying to find that's way out in the middle of the ocean, well, it's not moving, and it should be accurately marked on our charts. Especially in modern times, we have just remarkably accurate nautical charts. So the position of that island should be marked accurately, and you're going to be able to correct your course to sail right down to it. Now, just about anybody can easily learn how to use an electronic GPS unit, which is usually in these days just built into your electronic chart plotter, so it's just showing you exactly where you are. That's pretty easy to learn to use. Now, with just a little bit of training, you can also learn to use that visual fix method with shooting compass bearings, or the radar fix of shooting those radar distances to known objects. The thing is, once we're out of sight of land, those two kind of go away, and we're really limited to three navigational options. We have an electronic fix, dead reckoning, and celestial navigation. Now, we already talked about how easy it is for things to go wrong with your electronic navigation simply because it's dependent on that constant supply of electricity. Let's say you take a big wave and it splashes onto your chart plotter and fries the circuit board. That alone could be enough that your electronic navigation is fried. Let's say that you still have a backup GPS, maybe even a handheld battery-powered GPS. You can at least transfer the coordinates from that onto a paper chart. And I think we can all agree that we don't want to count on dead reckoning as our primary means of navigation. That's a good way to end up in trouble. That's a good way to run aground on a reef and sink your boat. So we're not going to rely on dead reckoning as our primary navigation. And we've already recognized that our electronic navigation is susceptible to not having electricity. So I don't know about you, but personally, especially if my life is on the line, I would like to have at least some sort of backup. And really our only possible backup option at this point, because we're out of sight of land, so we're not using our visual or our radar, so our only backup option is celestial navigation. So it's probably going to be important for you to learn some celestial navigation. Like I said, that's going to be the one that requires the most training. That can seem like a pretty daunting task, but I'm going to give you a really quick example of some celestial navigation that you can actually learn and execute pretty easily without having to shoot multiple stars and learn how to do all of the math for the reduction tables and translate that onto a paper chart and all of that. You don't necessarily have to learn all of that. there's one observation that you can make daily. Now, my preference would be to get a good fix much more than daily. And technically, this is not considered a good fix since it's only dependent on one single observation, not multiple observations that are kind of verifying each other. Anyway, this is a method that when done properly can give you a fairly accurate, actually the more precise you are in your measurements, the more accurate you are in your fix, in your position on the Earth. And that observation is something called local apparent noon. And local apparent noon is going to tell us both our latitude and our longitude. This is pretty cool. Now, to make this observation accurately, you do have to have a sextant. That's basically a tool. It's the triangular shaped brass thingy with all the knobs and numbers and stuff that you see people using on ships in old timey movies. And basically what this tool does is it has lenses and mirrors and those dials that basically allow you to look through it horizontally. So you're actually looking through the instrument horizontally at the horizon. And then with the mirrors, you can actually turn the knobs on the sextant to visually bring a celestial object down to the horizon to align them. And then holding everything in place, you can look at the instrument. And basically all that it's telling you is a precise angle measurement from the horizon up to that celestial body. So what is local apparent noon? Well, local apparent noon is not actually 12 o'clock in the time zone that you happen to be in. What it is whatever position you happen to be in, local apparent noon is the moment in time when the sun hits its highest point in the sky. So it rises in the east, sets in the west, generally speaking, not perfectly east and west. Now the top star in Orion's belt does rise perfectly in the east and set perfectly in the west. So if you can observe that event, either rise or set of that star, that gives you a very accurate east-west orientation. Polaris, North Star, always in the north. Also, the elevation above the horizon of Polaris in degrees gives you your latitude. For example, if you're on the equator, it's sitting on the horizon, 0 degrees latitude, 0 degrees of elevation. If you're on the North Pole, it's directly overhead, 90 degrees latitude, 90 degrees of elevation. Anyway, so if you can accurately measure the elevation of Polaris over the horizon, you can also get an accurate latitude. I digress. Local apparent noon. So to observe local apparent noon, there are two things that we're after. What we're going to do is we're going to take out our sextant, and the sextant has these built-in filters so that you can safely look at the sun. It's kind of like welding glass built in there. So you can safely look, quote, at the sun, bring the sun down to the horizon. And basically what you're going to do is around noon, slightly before noon, you're going to start observing the sun through your sextant. You're going to observe it slowly rising, and then at some point it's basically going to stop. And you, ideally, you should have it sitting right on the horizon at that point, and you're going to say mark to someone else or to yourself, whatever. And after that, you're going to observe the sun sinking lower. So it's going to apparently sink below the horizon if you continue to look through your sextant. There are two measurements that you need at this point. One is the elevation of the sun above the horizon that you just marked with your sextant at that moment when you observed it to reach its peak in the sky right before it started to sink back down. So that measurement in degrees, minutes, and seconds. And the other thing that you need is the time when you said mark. Now, first thing is the elevation of the sun above the horizon in degrees, minutes, and seconds. What that measurement is going to give you is based on the date and that measurement, you can accurately calculate your latitude. So I know that it's, say, March 26th. Well, on March 26th, if the sun is at this latitude or at this elevation above the horizon at local apparent noon, because as we all know, how high the sun gets in the sky changes seasonally. In the summer, it gets higher in the sky. In the winter, it stays lower in the sky. but you can measure that so precisely that you can get an accurate latitude. That's how far you are from the equator. So how about that time? Well, the time, basically what we're going to do with that time is we're going to compare it to the time at which we observed local apparent noon yesterday. Now, with what is called a sidereal day on Earth being 23 hours and 56 minutes, almost exactly, close enough, our observation, if we are traveling at all east to west, if our longitude is changing, our observation is going to be either more or less than 23 hours and 56 minutes from when we did the same observation yesterday. Now, side note here. When it comes to celestial navigation is done with the assumption that the Earth is a stationary object at the center of the universe and everything else goes around the Earth. Yeah, I know in reality that that's not how it actually works, but for purposes of navigation, making that assumption makes all of the math much, much easier. So if I'm speaking in terms as though it sounds like I think that the sun goes around the Earth, I know that the Earth goes around the sun. But for purposes of navigation, it's easier to assume that the Earth is stationary and the sun is going around the Earth, as it would appear to for all of us Earthlings who are living on the Earth. Anyway, so as the sun goes around the Earth, rises in the east, sets in the west, if we are traveling in somewhat of a general westerly direction, think of us as like chasing the sun. And if you're going fast enough, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 miles an hour at the equator, the sun would actually remain stationary in the sky in relation to you. So if we're traveling in that westerly direction, the faster we're going, the more degrees of arc we're covering on the surface of the Earth, the longer our apparent day is going to become. So if we're traveling west, our apparent day is going to be longer than that 23 hours and 56 minutes. And basically what we can do is take the difference. Let's say that it's, I'm not going to run the math on an actual reduction sheet right now, but let's say that it's, 10 minutes different. So 10 minutes longer. So instead of being 23 hours and 56 minutes, it's 24 hours and 6 minutes. Well, that tells me that I've covered that equivalent of 10 minutes of time divided out into that 23 hours and 56 minutes multiplied by the 360 degrees around the circumference of the Earth, and I can figure out how many of those degrees of longitude I've actually traveled since my last fix. So we've gotten a good local apparent noon observation that's given us a longitude and a latitude. What we can do is then go to our chart, draw a line, a vertical north-south line at our known longitude, and a horizontal east-west line on our chart at our known latitude. Where those two lines cross is our current position. So in a movie, if you see a guy like out on the deck of a ship in the middle of the day, apparently staring through this sextant toward the horizon and takes some measurements and then plots a position on a chart, that's exactly what he just did. Okay, I'm back. I had to pause the recording and go do a bunch of stuff, pick the kids up from school. We went to art lessons, came home, made dinner, exercised the dogs again, did some doggy training sessions, and got the kids in bed. Back to recording now. So I had to listen to the last little bit that I recorded. We were talking about celestial navigation, specifically about how to use local apparent noon to determine both your latitude and longitude. And one thing that I should mention as I re-listened to this, instead of calculating your longitude based on your previous day's observation of local apparent noon, if possible, you should actually base it on like your earliest possible previous observation of local apparent noon at a known position, if that makes sense. If that doesn't make sense, don't worry about it. Now, the other thing that you're going to do is anytime that you get a chance to get a visual fix, like maybe you're sailing past an island or something that has some points that you can triangulate to get a good visual fix, you should go ahead and do that. And that's actually going to give you kind of like a more accurate position, and then you can kind of recalibrate from there. Now, that's assuming that you're not using your electronic navigation, but even if you are using your electronic navigation, your GPS, you can kind of double check it with these other methods. And honestly, like being able to shoot the sun at noon every day and come up with a latitude and longitude is just going to make you feel like that much more competent of a mariner. And it's not bad practice for the event when you might actually have to do that as your primary means of navigation. So I guess to actually answer your question, I should say when you're navigating, you're not just setting a course and trying to follow that course based on the way that you steer. You're actually getting new accurate positions as often as possible, relating that to where you're trying to get to and adjusting your course accordingly. So hope that made sense. Hope that answered your questions. All right, next question. Hello, this is my first time writing into any of the podcasts that I listen to. Well, thanks. I feel flattered. I know that you were trying to explain how cruising the world in a sailboat is actually within reach for most of us, but I'm still skeptical. For me, planting a window garden for the first time was a big adventure, and a spider in my flat was bloody terrifying. I think the window garden may have actually attracted the spider, but that's another story. It just seems that the sea is so dangerous that sailing a boat out of sight of land would be reckless. What about sharks? What about jellyfish? Big waves? Underwater rocks? Drug smugglers? Storms? Hurricanes? Million other dangerous things. I've heard that piracy is still a very real thing too. Can you address some of these issues? Would you just live with the risk or do something about it? Okay, so I'm not going to address each and every individual one of those concerns, but yes, all of those are very real hazards. Some of them statistically more likely to be an issue than others. And oftentimes the things that people are most worried about are statistically the least likely things to happen. So I think the first thing that we need to address is the spiders being attracted to your window garden, because my recommendation here would actually just be to plant some mint in your window garden, because mint, from what I hear, supposedly, allegedly, is actually a pretty good spider repellent. Now, for each of those other issues, more the sailing issues, hazards of the sea, for each of those, what you really need to do is, first of all, get an accurate idea in your mind of how much of a risk it actually is. And then, what can you do to mitigate that risk? For example, we kind of already talked about like the hurricanes. So there are certain parts of the Atlantic that you might just not sail through during hurricane season. When it comes to, I believe you called it, underwater rocks. So the hazard there would be running aground, which is actually one of the most likely things to happen to you as far as bad things that could happen. Things that could, like disasters that could happen, cruising the world in your sailing vessel. Running aground is statistically one of the more likely things to go wrong. And you can mitigate that hazard with your navigational skills and navigational practices. In modern times, there just aren't any uncharted islands or reefs out there. We have pretty good navigational charts of the entire world. So with proper navigational practices, you should not run aground. So how about something like piracy? Yes, you're absolutely right. Piracy is still a very real thing. But with a little bit of research, you can actually look up maps that have like little pins where all of the recorded instances of piracy have occurred in the last 10 years, 20 years, whatever you want to look up. And you're going to see some patterns. And you could simply take some measures like avoiding those areas, because most of those instances of piracy are concentrated in actually fairly small, predictable areas. So, like I said, I'm not going to address each of these hazards on this episode of the podcast, but I guess the short answer is you need to approach each of those hazards as its own individual thing. Don't approach danger as a big topic in and of itself and say, oh, I'm just going to live with the risk. No. Each of those individual hazards, you can look at it, you can learn about it, you can learn what the actual risks are and take measures to mitigate that risk to the point where you're comfortable living with any remaining risk. All right, next question. We only have two to go. Hey, Isaac, I had no idea you had sailing experience as well. Very cool! Exclamation point. I appreciate how well you explain things, especially for people with no experience in whatever the subject matter is that you're covering. That said, I was totally lost when you were talking about the benefits of a boat with multiple masts versus a single mast. Not sure if I missed something or if you just got distracted while covering so much information, but I'm wondering if you can provide some additional information on sailing a boat with one mast versus two. Thanks. Yes. And you're absolutely right. I might have just gotten distracted and not actually covered that. So let's cover it right now. So when we're talking about a boat with one mast versus two, in general, we're talking about a sloop, which is going to have one mast and generally two large sails, versus a ketch or a yawl or a schooner, which is going to have two masts. Now, the yawl, I basically think of as a schooner, not as a schooner, I'm sorry, as a sloop with like a little bonus mast and sail. So think of that still as being basically a one-masted boat. Now, the ketch and the schooner have two basically full-sized masts. The difference being that a schooner has a mainmast and a foremast, meaning that of the two, the one that's further aft is taller. The ketch has a mainmast and a mizzen, meaning of the two, the one that's further forward is taller. Now, here's the actual thing to understand. A boat of a certain size, whether you're measuring that in length or displacement or whatever, is basically going to have to carry certain sail area to propel it through the water. I know I'm oversimplifying this just like I do on a lot of stuff. But if you can have two masts instead of one, you can divide that sail area into more individual sails. So you might think, oh, well, more individual sails, that's going to be more complex to sail. Yes, that is true. The actual handling of those sails becomes more complex because there are more of them, but the physical force that the wind is exerting on those sails becomes less for each individual sail because each individual sail for the same size boat ends up being smaller on that ketch or schooner rig. Now, why does that matter? Well, it matters because the wind is exerting force on the sail and the sheets or the lines that you use to trim the sails are going to have to pull against that force. So the less physical force you have on a sail, the easier it is to haul around on that line to trim the sail. So in short, basically what I'm saying is when you are working your sails, you physically don't have to pull as hard on the lines to handle your sails. Now the other advantage, which depending on where you're sailing, this may or may not be a factor for you, but the other advantage that you have with dividing that sail area amongst multiple masts instead of having all of your sail on one mast is that your masts are physically shorter, meaning your bridge clearance is much lower. So the bridges that you have to wait, like drawbridges that you actually have to wait for a drawbridge opening, may be fewer with that shorter mast rigging. That's probably the lesser of all of the factors. So I would consider more when you're deciding between a boat with single mast versus multiple masts, I would consider the handling of the sails and simply the look of the boat. Like, what do you like? What appeals to you more? Let that drive your decision more than what bridges you can sail under, or more likely, if you're actually passing under a bridge, you're not going to be under sail. I don't recommend that. You're probably going to be under motor power at that point. Anyway, let those other factors drive your decision more than bridge clearance. So, hope that answers your question. All right, last question. This question says, "Hi, my husband and I just finished listening to the second part of the, quote, Pirate's Life episode. And we were casually discussing how much fun it would be going on sailing adventures like you described. Both of us grew up around boats, fishing boats and ski boats in the Midwest, but we realized that sailing offshore would be something completely different." Yes, I'm glad you're realizing that. "And we'd have a lot of learning to do before we even thought about planning a trip. You did mention that there is legal precedent that says that it is negligent to sail long distances single-handed because you wouldn't be maintaining a, quote, lookout while you're sleeping. That makes sense, but it seems like even with two people taking turns sleeping, parentheses, is there a term for that, there would still be a lot to handle. If you're the one driving, how can you pull on ropes, parentheses, I'm sure there's a term for that too, get a cup of coffee, etc. Do sailboats have any sort of autopilot options? Thanks for all the great information and fun stories." Okay, first question about when you're taking turns sleeping and driving. Yes, there's a term for that, and it's called your watch rotation. So basically what you're going to do here is, like you said, take turns sleeping versus driving. Now, you always have to have somebody who is on watch. Now, you're legally required to maintain that proper lookout at all times. Now, on a smaller sailing boat, like we're talking about, your lookout and the person who is, quote, driving, is probably going to be the same person most of the time. And when you're sailing offshore on open water, it's totally feasible to sail single-handed. So you can steer, you can trim the sails, you can keep an eye on your radar, you can man the radio and maintain a visual lookout simultaneously just fine by yourself. The trouble is, once you extend the period of time where you're doing that, eventually you're going to have to sleep. So if you have even two people, now if you have more than two, it becomes even easier, but if you have even two people, you could do like a 4-hour watch rotation where the 24 hours of the day get divided into 6 4-hour watches and you alternate watches. So for example, from midnight to 0400, one person would be on watch, the other person's off and probably asleep. From 04 to 08, you switch. 08 to noon, switch again. Noon to 1600, excuse me. 1600 to 2000 and 2000 to midnight. So 4-hour watches, there are six of them in a day, and you would be responsible for three of them. Now, this is not something that you want to maintain indefinitely. Now, if you have three or four people to rotate watches, you can definitely maintain that indefinitely, where you're, say if you have three people and you're on for four, off for eight, well, you could definitely sleep for one of your 8-hour periods where you're off and even be awake for both of your watches and your other 8-hour off period and maintain that just fine. And that's with three people standing watch. With two, it gets a little rough because you never get more than 4 hours of sleep in any one stretch. But if you're only maintaining that for a matter of a few days or even a few weeks, you can function pretty well as long as you manage your sleep in your off periods where the other person is on watch. Now, the other thing to realize, though, is if anything happens during the other person's watch, like some severe weather comes up, or there's some more complex maneuvers, tacking or jibing, that you need to execute, they're going to have to wake you up from your, quote, off time. Just because you're off, you're not on watch, doesn't mean that you're guaranteed sleep through that entire period. So with only two people alternating watches and occasionally getting woken up, I mean, like I said, keep in mind, you only have that 4 hour block, and so you're only getting maybe 3 to 4 hours of sleep anyway during that 4 hour block. And then if that gets interrupted, also, like I said, you don't want to maintain that for more than like days or possibly a few weeks at a time. But add, like I said, three or four people cycling through watches, and it's actually pretty easy. And that 4 hour rotation has actually been kind of tried and true and tested through naval tradition, even to the point where each of those 4 hour watches has its own name. Let's see if I can remember them all. So starting at midnight, you have the mid watch, the morning watch, the forenoon watch, the noon watch, the dog watch, and the evening watch. Anyway, the other part of your question is basically, even if you are the one on watch, it seems like there's still a lot to handle between steering, whether that's at a helm or a tiller, and anything else that needs to be done. Trimming the sails, like you said, even getting a cup of coffee. Do sailboats have some sort of autopilot options? So, yes, they do. Let's talk about kind of three autopilot options and maybe some of the pros and cons of each. And I've actually used all three of these. So the first one is an actual, what I would call, electronic autopilot. And this is a system that has an electronic compass built into it and is integrated with your chart plotter and GPS and so on. So you have your course drawn into your chart plotter. And basically, if you drift right, of course, it's going to steer left. If you drift left, of course, it's going to steer right to try to keep you on course. And that works great when it comes to motor vessels. The trouble with using that type of system on sailing vessels is that it doesn't account for any shifts in the wind direction. So it may keep you on course okay, but like we talked about, on all of those different points of sail, relative to the direction of wind, you're going to have to trim your sails slightly differently. So once you get your sails trimmed, if you're steering a certain course, let's say you're steering due west on a beam reach, your sails are trimmed for a beam reach headed due west. Now your autopilot is going to keep you headed due west, but let's say that over the course of several hours, the wind shifts maybe a few degrees, maybe a lot of degrees, maybe 45 degrees, which could actually shift you from being on a beam reach to being close hauled. And without an according shift in the trim of your sails, that's going to be a problem. So, what are some other options? Well, one other option is just constantly trimming your sails while your autopilot is keeping you steered on a certain course. But that has its own limitations. Let's say that you're sailing close hauled on a port tack and the wind shifts just 5 or 10 degrees. Now all of a sudden you're in that kind of no-go zone where you're head into the wind, and even if you changed the trim of your sails, you can't keep up with that. So particularly with sailing vessels, the electronic autopilot really just has some major weaknesses. So what are some other options? Well, we're going to talk about two, and one is a wind vane autopilot, and the other is called a sheet to tiller steerage. So let's talk about the simpler one first, which would be the sheet to tiller steerage. Basically, the way that this works is, assuming that you have your sails properly trimmed and balanced so that your boat is tending to steer on course in relation to the wind, like we talked about, the more pressure on the jib is going to make you fall off the wind because it's further forward. More pressure on the main is going to make your boat turn into the wind. But when you have them properly trimmed and balanced, your boat is going to tend to steer on course. Now, you can actually add to that tendency to steer on course by basically taking a line, running it to your main sheet. Now, that's the line rope that hauls in the mainsail. And you're going to run a line from the main sheet through a block or pulley that's on the windward side of your boat, like up on the windward rail and back to the tiller. Going the other way from your tiller down to the leeward side of your boat, you're going to have some sort of, usually people use a bungee cord, some sort of more stretchy rope of some sort. And basically, without going into all of the details of the mechanics of how this works, basically what happens is, because of the added tension in the main sheet, if your boat drifts a little bit into the wind, it's going to pull that tiller to steer you off of the wind. And if your boat drifts off of the wind, it's going to pull the tiller the other direction to steer you into the wind. And it's really kind of just a beautifully elegantly simple system. And it takes some tuning and it takes some practice to set one of these sheet to tiller steerage systems up, but it actually works pretty well. Now, one of the great things about this, though, is that if the wind changes direction over the course of several hours, the boat doesn't notice, and the boat maintains the same course in relation to the wind, meaning that you don't have to change the trim of your sails. So if you're doing some sort of like transoceanic crossing, let's say we're crossing the Atlantic Ocean, and we know that there's no land within 1,000 miles of where we are, so there is zero hazard of running aground if we're a few miles off course, we could set one of these systems and basically set it and forget it. And if the wind shifts a little bit, we're going to steer a little bit off course. But with those trade winds that are fairly consistent, we're actually going to be able to basically take our hands off the tiller and whatever, read a book, go get a cup of coffee, and kind of not worry about things and just let the boat sail itself. And it's going to maintain that same heading in relation to the wind. Now, when we adjust things, we can, you know, plot our new position like we talked about, adjust our course, and adjust that sheet to tiller steerage system. Now, the next system is called a wind vane autopilot. And this is kind of somewhere in between those two. It's a little more complex than just a sheet to tiller line. And I should say, but it maintains our steerage in relation to the wind, not in relation to the course that we plotted electronically. Now, the way that this works is basically the same as the sheet to tiller, except that it has a few more moving parts. And I would say, despite all of those moving parts, is actually easier to learn to use. So basically the way that this works is you get on course, trim your sails, and set your wind vane on your wind vane autopilot into the wind. At that point, what it does is, like I said, similar to that sheet to tiller system, but basically if the boat falls off of the wind and you have that wind vane locked in, it's going to push the wind vane to one side. Now, mechanically, that's going to transfer through this kind of drive linkage down into this little basically rudder that's riding in the water. And since it's traveling through the water, that rudder is going to have the force to then transfer energy to either your tiller or helm, depending on how your boat is rigged up for steerage. And so, like I said, if it falls off the wind, you have all of this sequence of mechanical events. And this is a completely mechanical system also, which is, in my mind, an advantage because you don't have to have any electricity, any power, any electronics running for this to work. You set it, and your boat is going to steer on the same course in relation to the wind. So, like I said, your boat falls off the wind a little bit. It pushes that wind vane off to that side, and that wind vane pushes the little miniature rudder that's down in the water one direction, and that pulls on a line and pulls on your tiller and steers the boat back into the wind. Now your boat steers into the wind a little bit. The opposite thing happens. The wind vane kind of flops over to the other side because now the wind's blowing on the other side of it, and the little rudder that's riding down in the water goes the other direction, pulls your tiller the other way, and adjusts your course off of the wind. So these work really well. The main disadvantage of these is that they are more expensive than simply rigging up a sheet-to-tiller system, because a sheet-to-tiller you could literally rig up for the cost of, 10 feet of rope and a bungee cord. So that's basically zero cost, very minimal cost, as opposed to these actual wind vane steerage systems, which I'm going to say work better and are easier to learn to use. So there's kind of your pros and cons there. So I would say, weighing the pros and cons of those three options, for most people, the wind vane autopilot system is probably going to be the best, because the electronic system requires a whole lot more attention, because you could actually have a knockdown event if the wind shifts direction or you backwind your sails or whatever because you didn't realize the wind was shifting direction and your autopilot was still trying to steer you along the same course. So there's some hazards there. So that requires a lot more active attention. And the sheet-to-tiller system just requires a little more savvy as a sailor to really get that tuned well. The wind vane autopilot system, I think, is just a really good balance between the two, and is you don't have that disadvantage of steering electronically. It's still just steering to the wind, so you can travel for hundreds of miles without ever adjusting anything. And just, if the wind's blowing from the north and you're steering, say directly east, it'll keep you on a perfect beam reach until you make an adjustment. So, I think that's just a really good kind of compromise for most sailors. That's going to be kind of where they settle in as their best option. Because honestly, like, having your hand physically on the helm or tiller for a full 4-hour watch, that's eventually going to just kind of wear on you a little bit and wear you down. You're going to get tired. You're going to get fatigued from that activity of constantly steering. So being able to set up one of these other options that's basically going to steer for you, that you have enough confidence that you can go below and get some coffee or whatever for a few minutes, is really going to make your 4-hour watch a lot easier to handle. So I think that's kind of what you were asking in your question. I hope that gave you some more information and insight as to how that might actually go, especially if you are doing some longer trip like a transatlantic, that 21 to 25 day Atlantic crossing with only two people, which is totally doable. But some of these little helps like the wind vane steerage system might make that a lot more pleasant of a crossing. So I think that's all we had for questions. Let me turn the page here and make sure. Yep, that's all we had. I printed out your questions that you sent in, so thank you for sending me questions. That was awesome, and I wasn't expecting quite that much engagement from one topic, so it's pretty awesome. Apparently it's something all of you, or at least some of you, are interested in, so I'm glad it piqued your interest talking about sailing. That's all we have for this week. For any of you who are thinking about sending me other questions about other topics, you can email those to me, contact@masterofnonepodcast.com. There's also a contact page on the website. The website is masterofnonepodcast.com, where we have show notes for most of the episodes. Working on getting kind of caught up on that. You can see some pictures, resources, links, and stuff on that. And if you want to see what I'm currently doing, you can give me a follow on Instagram. I am at isaac.r.gordon. That's isaac.r.gordon. And admittedly, recently I have fallen behind in keeping Instagram up to date with interesting and engaging photographs, but I'm going to try to do better at that. And until next time, remember, me eyes is stars, me teeth is spars, me hair is hemp and seaweed. And pursue your mastercraft. You savvy? Theme music for the Master of None podcast is Club Seamus by Kevin MacLeod. Incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. CreativeCommons.org. If you need some of your own original music, go check out Kevin's other work at his website, Incompetech.com.